Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins. I work for Fairway Markets in the New York area, and we're awfully proud to support Heritage Radio, and we care so much about everything that goes on out here at Roberta's in their studio, because they talk to people who are serious about food, and that's what we are at Fairway, is we're serious about food. We just care very deeply about you as a customer, and how you cook and what you cook with and how you entertain, and that's why we love to support Heritage Radio, because it's pretty much the same thing. It's wanting to find happiness through serious food and people who are serious about it and care about learning everything there is to learn about it. And that's we're kindred spirits. If it's something worth having in your kitchen, you're going to find it at Fairway. And if there's somebody worth talking to about food, you're going to find them on Heritage Radio, and we will be supporting you guys for a long, long time. At Fairway, I'm your personal grocer, Steve Jenkins, Fairway Market.
Greetings, everybody. This is Carol Butler. I'm the co-host of the Naturalist program, originated by Bernie Wides, who is traveling today, but he'll be back shortly. So I will do my best without him. Today I want to talk about bed bugs, and it's a big topic. Everybody is interested. I've been interested in writing a book about bed bugs for the past year. And anybody who knows that I'm interested in bed bugs only wants to know how to get rid of them. So I'm not going to talk about how to get rid of them today at length. I will just mention that if you have them, the detection dogs are trained to locate them in your space, and you need to call a professional who will come and take you through the steps that are necessary to get rid of them. I will do a program on detection and removal at another time, but I'm interested today to talk about the way bed bugs reproduce. They reproduce by what is called traumatic extragenital insemination, and that is really quite a description of what is involved. This type of reproduction occurs in only a small number of taxa, but it's found in all members of the bedbug family. We're going to talk about the specific behavior of C. lectularis, which is the bedbug species for which humans are the primary host. Although they can survive in laboratory, sometimes they feed them on rabbit blood when they're using them in experiments. Just out of curiosity, some of the other species that reproduce by traumatic insemination are different types of worms. Pinworms. My daughter had pinworms once when she was very, very young. Parasitic thorny-headed worms, free-living flatworms, snails, certain kind of gastropod snails, certain parasites, twisted-wing parasites to be exact, and Drosophila, which is interesting. We know what those are, fruit flies. In fruit flies, the ejaculates are injected through the body wall into the genital tract, which is different than what happens with bed bugs. Sea slugs also mate this way, and they do it also differently. There are repeated small injections into the dorsal surface of the partner. The dorsal is the back, interrupted by synchronized circling movements and culminating in a standard genital insemination. There's also a spider in Israel that mates this way, and the male pierces the female's body cavity and inseminates her ovaries directly. So those are just some of the dazzling variations. Okay, bed bugs, like a lot of bugs and also mollusks, snails and slugs, cephalopods, squids, bivalves, mollusks, mussels are bivalves. These animals all have what's called an open circulatory system. They have no blood vessels like we have, no veins and arteries. Their body fluid circulates freely in the spaces between the organs. Okay. Female bedbugs do have a functional reproductive tract, but they use it to deposit their eggs. And I love entomologists. In the course of thousands of observations, as you can imagine the entomologists observing this, they have never observed a male bedbug copulate with a female via her genital opening. Instead, bedbugs mate by traumatic extragenital insemination, which we will explain. You just need a little more introduction. Sorry about that. Mating is linked to the bedbug's feeding cycle, and the literature seems to say that starved bedbugs don't mate. They assume refusal postures, pressing themselves against the nearest wall or floor, or slightly curling the tip of their abdomen forward under the body to make themselves inaccessible to males who want to mate. My colleague Lou Sorkin, who is the bedbug man at the Museum of Natural History, where Bernie and I work, says that he has watched what appear to be unfed males try to mate with what appear to be unfed females. So there's always some variation or exceptions. It's hard to say anything definite about animals, but mostly they don't mate with unfed females. When they do this research, when they study mating, they do it with females who have recently fed. And a recently fed female's body volume is increased by about 300%. So you can imagine she looks quite different from a starved female. Of course, the recently fed male is also larger, but they're slightly different in size. Movement of any bedbug-sized object in the vicinity of a male causes him to approach. And if the disturbance turns out to be a recently fed adult, the male promptly mounts her or him. Once the male is mounted on the back of the potential mate, sort of obliquely across her body from her left shoulder to her right rear side, if you are a visual person, I'm trying to picture this, he begins probing her abdomen with his paramour. Now, I put some wonderful photographs on the website, which you should look at. The paramour is his genital appendage. It extends from the tip of his abdomen, and it's kind of a little bit sickle-shaped. It's a hardened, pin-like organ. And he, when he's not copulating, it sits in a groove, sort of a recessed area, which you can see clearly in the scanning electron microscope photograph that I posted on the website. It's really a fantastic photograph, which I borrowed from a journal article. During copulation, it flips out to pierce the female's body, and he first searches her side. He searches her abdomen, searches her right ventral side, that's the bottom, for the ectospermolodge, which is part of the two-part paragenital reproductive organ, the paragenital, again, outside the normal genital tract. So the ectospermolodge is something he can feel with his paramour, and it marks the place where he can enter her reproductive system. He doesn't penetrate the female's abdomen randomly, but yeah, females have a structure, which you can also see in the photograph. It's kind of two curved, I don't know how to describe it, but you'll see it. It guides the piercing organ to the proper spot. If he feels that ridge, it will guide him to the opening, so that the male gets tactile and behavioral signals that help him quickly figure out that this is a female rather than a male. Males typically detach from other males after a few seconds, so this all happens quite efficiently. And scientists have studied males that had been mounted and found that they don't have mating scars or any wounds or any signs that they've been injected with sperm. My poor engineer is coughing. He has bronchitis. I hear him from far away. However, under sexually isolated lab conditions, male-male inseminations have been known to occur, But they were fatal to the recipient males. Okay, so the male remains coupled with a female for a minute or so, while the penis, which lies within a groove, and you can even see that in the photo, the penis ejaculates bundles of sperm into the female. Then he leaves. And anywhere from 3 to 8 other males usually follow and mate with the female while she's still engorged with blood. She's sluggish, and she doesn't, they say she doesn't resist. She certainly doesn't make any sign of resistance. It seems to me she would resist if she could, but her ability to resist is compromised by her engorged condition, and that gives the male a reproductive advantage. There's a whole series of material about whether invertebrates feel pain or not. And if there was a definite answer, I would give it to you, but I really can't. They do react to changes in temperature, to chemicals, to electric shock, that sort of thing that would cause us pain. They generally respond by withdrawing or trying to escape. That's their defense, of course. But it's really hard to know whether she's in pain while this is happening or not. So the sperm is ejaculated through the opening in the abdomen into a membrane-covered sac, sorry. That's the second part of this organ. And if you think of a hair follicle or a gland in the skin, to me that's how it looks in my mind. It's a sac that contains the ejaculate when it goes into the body. It provides an adaptive advantage in that it contains the ejaculate and responds to the sperm. The sperm cells, I don't want to get ahead of myself. Okay, let me just describe it first, and then I'll talk more about the function of the mesospermolage. Sperm cells remain in the mesospermolage for about 4 hours. Then they begin to migrate into the female's body fluid, her hemolymph, which is, remember, floating around all of the organs. And they travel to a pair of specialized storage organs, which are called the seminal conceptacles. And eventually they arrive at the ovaries through hemolymph-filled canals that run inside the oviduct walls. And the sperm either fertilize mature eggs in the ovaries or they die. It's sort of curious that fertilization occurs in the ovaries of a bedbug, since in most species it only takes place once the eggs have left the ovary. So if you look at the illustration, you will see in A, you can see the paramere with the groove that it... we're going to take a break in a moment. With the groove, and even with the groove that it rests in, and the little opening where the penis stays inside the sheath, and you can see the illustration B of the bedbug, where there's a square that marks actually where the ectospermolage is located. And then in figure C, you can see the detail of the incurving tissue that leads to the ectospermolage. Okay. Let's take a break, and I will continue in a moment. This is Carol Butler again. Welcome back to the Naturalist program, where we're talking about bedbug reproduction, one of my favorite subjects. I mentioned some research in the earlier section, but I want to talk now about some more experiments with bedbugs. I wouldn't particularly want to be the one doing these experiments, but I really love research design, and I really admire the focus of people who do careful experimental work and then publish the results in a really useful way. And in general, I'm fascinated with people who are extraordinarily interested and knowledgeable about one particular thing. That's been the fun of writing my books. So this fits right in, and hopefully this will be book number 9. I'm not going to go into detail about who the researchers are, so that if I make mistakes, it won't be attributed to them. But if you're interested in looking at this research, it's easy enough to Google it, and it'll pop right up, and you can read the details for yourself. I've had to condense it a little bit and summarize it so I could get it into the program. But there's a group at Sheffield in the United Kingdom who are very busy with bedbugs. At the moment, they're actually studying bedbug ejaculate. But in the earlier research, they began by isolating females who had only been mated once, in order to study their fertility rate, and they found that they continued to lay an average of 1.4 fertilized eggs daily for 4 weeks after just one mating. When allowed to feed freely, bedbugs feed every 6 or 7 days, and remember, they only mate when they're full. So they feed every 6 or 7 days and then mate and remate an average of 5 times, as many as 8 times, with the result that males are effectively imposing a mating rate that is 20 to 25 times higher than is required for the female to remain fertile. For her to continue laying eggs, all she needs is to mate once. Instead, she mates 20, 25 times if it's up to the males. And the result over the same 4-week period, when you compare it to a singly mated lab female, is that the multiply mated female's lifespan is reduced. They die by 25 or 30%. In many species in life, the frequency with which males and females prefer to mate is rarely the same, because of the evolutionary advantages of mating frequently or mating seldom. Bernie, I know you would love to say something about this, and I'm also, this is very much in the evolution of human sexuality, which is one of my other favorite topics. But so the question is, what is the evolutionary advantage for the female of this repeated traumatic mating that shortens her life? One explanation could be that, and this is what the people are working on who are doing bedbug research, one of the things. One possible explanation could be that it reduces the risk of genetically incompatible sperm that would lead to infertile eggs or reduced offspring fitness. This is often one of the reasons that we understand there's multiple mating. But the experimental data so far didn't find a difference in the number of infertile eggs laid by multiply mated females versus singly mated females. But there's more work now on egg production, so we'll see what the literature says. Research in Sweden at Uppsala University, and also in tandem with the folks at Sheffield, is also very interesting. They used pins or needles to inflict copulation-like trauma on females in order to study the functions of the spermalodge. In experiments using laboratory animals, these are animals born and bred in the lab so that they are controlled, they were fed weekly, and young adults were placed in individual tubes to ensure their virginity prior to the experiments. Okay, so in one experiment, groups of females were housed until they died, either with 4 virgin males, this is called the high mating group, or with 4 virgin males, 3 of which had their paramere glued into the paramere groove with super glue, making them unable to copulate. This is obviously the low mating group. So this procedure attempted to isolate the effect of copulation, right, high mating or low mating, while controlling for the effects of exposure to males or male harassment. that obviously, even though the male's paramour was glued into the groove, they would probably be trying to mate. Again, I can't give you all the details, but you can assume that they were following their instincts and trying to mate. All right, so here's again the reasoning for one of the experiments. After feeding, bedbugs typically return to their refuge, which is a crack in the wall or some other spot, and it's full of other bedbugs, other bugs, alive and dead, shed skins, and the excretion from digested blood meals that contains a range of fungi and bacteria. So it's kind of a nasty place. So then the researchers decided to study the effect of the introduction by copulating males of some of these microbes that would be naturally found on the male's body, including his paramour. They wanted to observe whether an immune response in the female is stimulated. So one group used contaminated pins to simulate the piercing of the paramour. Female bedbugs were pierced for 1 minute, which is the usual duration of copulation, through the ectospermolage, either with a sterilized pin or with a contaminated pin. How did they contaminate the pin, you may ask? They wiped it over the surface of contaminated filter paper from a jar containing a bedbug colony. Other females were pierced in a parallel spot on the left side so that they were pierced directly into the abdomen, either with a sterilized or a contaminated pin. I hope you get the idea of this. Basically, the number of eggs laid by females pierced directly in the abdomen, even with a sterile pin, was reduced, but by 12.5% in comparison to females pierced with sterile pins in the ectospermolage. When the pins were contaminated, egg numbers were reduced enormously, by almost 90% when the contaminated pins were inserted in the abdomen, which means that the contamination went straight into the hemolymph and just spread throughout the body, and by 70% when they were inserted in the ectospermolage. So even a low rate of piercing outside the spermolage reduced egg production considerably, and also kills them. When females were penetrated by a contaminated pin, they experienced a fivefold reduction in survival. When the contaminated pins were inserted in the abdomen instead of the ectospermolage, there was a 3.2-fold reduction in longevity. So clearly the spermolage functions as a defense against the introduction of pathogens, other foreign components, and protects the body, protects the hemolymph from these pathogens. Also, they didn't examine the... let me skip that. This system has developed, certainly at least in part, to confine wounding to a restricted part of the abdomen where there is this increased efficiency in the immune system. So the spermolage may have additional functions, but it didn't seem to have an effect on wound healing, since females pierced with sterile pins didn't differ in how long they lived, regardless of where they were stabbed. The literature says that wounds heal quickly, although they do leave scars. Okay, I think this is a good place to pause. And we have one more section where we'll talk more about ejaculate. Thank you, Jack, for that beautiful music. All right, this is the last section of the Naturalist Show about bedbugs. It's Carol Butler continuing. So now we're talking about ejaculate. In theory, male animals should increase their investment in their ejaculate. Investment means the amount of energy they put into it. In order to maximize their chances of fathering offspring, when females of the species are polyandrous, like bedbug females. Polyandrous means mating with multiple males, so that there's sperm competition. I've talked about butterflies that fill up the female's reproductive tract with non-fertile sperm in order to physically discourage her from mating again in short order. And there's interesting research on the promiscuous bank vole, which is a small mouse-like mammal. In this research, they found that males exposed to the odor of rival males developed larger seminal vesicles, which are the accessory reproductive glands. And the odor stimulated larger seminal vesicles and assumedly more seminal fluid. So this is like in the butterflies. There's more of an investment in non-sperm components of the ejaculate. In the case of the voles, the sperm production was not affected by the illusion of competition from the odor. There's another recent publication. You can see that I got into this. There's another recent publication about the ejaculatory strategies of flower beetles. Again, I love entomologists. If the flower beetle loses a fight for a female, their aggressiveness is decreased for up to 4 days, but during that period, they show increased investment in their ejaculate. Interestingly, in the winner of the fight, there was no change in the ejaculate, whatever that means. Okay. I will go on with this. I hope I don't go over time. There's a very interesting line of research about sperm competition in humans. In 2004, this was actually done in the state universities in upstate New York, they examined the possibility that the shape of the human penis may have evolved to compete with sperm from other males by displacing rival semen from the cervical end of the vagina. So if a female had copulated with more than one male within a short period of time, the structure of the human penis, and they did this, of course, they had models, artificial models of penises and vagina. They also had a good time in the laboratory. The structure of the human penis, they showed it experimentally, will scoop out semen deposited by others before the person doing this ejaculates. They even hypothesized that it would be possible for a female to become pregnant by a man she had not had sex with. Now, this hypothetically could occur if the male extracted and carried the sperm on his penis and then had sex with another woman, right? So he would be delivering the extracted foreign sperm. Okay, but we digress from bed bugs a little bit. In the bed bug, the ejaculate remains in the mesospermillage for at least 4 hours after insemination. Researchers found out that it takes 2 days after mating has ended for there to be absolutely no detectable sperm remaining in the mesospermillage, but it stays at least for 4 hours. So that it's likely that the paramir of a subsequent male will come in contact with the ejaculate of his predecessor or predecessors. And there are scanning electron microscope photos of the surface of the paramir, which show short pegs. I didn't include that photograph, but they resemble what are known as sensory structures, which suggests that the paramir probably has some sensory reaction to dipping into the fluid of the mesospermillage. So there were experiments devised using laboratory-raised virgin males and females to study the size of the ejaculates of a female's various mates. After copulation ended, the females were freeze-killed and dissected. The mesospermillage was removed, placed on a microscope slide, and prepared and studied so that the volume of the sperm mass could be calculated. And they found that the first male to mate with the female copulated 50% longer and produced more ejaculate. So why is that? That's pretty interesting. The theory is that since the mesospermolage is full of phagocytes, which are cells that engulf and absorb waste material, perhaps because the phagocytes are sort of full strength when the first ejaculate arrives, the first male needs to compensate with a larger ejaculate for the potential destruction of his sperm by this disproportionate phagocytic attack, right? That may be triggered when he penetrates and dips his paramere into the mesospermolage. There's interesting, very interesting, unpublished data that compared the results of controlled double mating and shows that there was equal fertilization success for the first and second males, despite the fact that the first male copulates so much longer and has a larger ejaculate. So there you go. Sexual selection by sperm competition certainly would seem to favor first males who have a larger ejaculate size. So the entomologists in Sheffield have been working on bedbug ejaculate. Again, love the idea of it, just imagine it. And there's new research suggesting that there are components of the ejaculate that seem to compensate the female for the fact that she suffers through this, for the elevated rates of reproduction. That compensates the female for living a shorter time by delaying the onset of basically bedbug menopause. So she lives a shorter time, but she can lay eggs for longer based on some components in the ejaculate. So this is all very interesting stuff, and I'm sure we will hear more about it. And that's about what I have to say for today on this fascinating topic. I really hope it was interesting to you without Bernie's comments. It's much more fun when Bernie has something to say. But I thank you for listening, and I thank Fairway, and I thank Jack, my engineer, and I hope you'll listen again.